I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Blood Ties. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being there. Thank you for helping us. It's been a very, very interesting time. I watched The Good Nurse this week, the Eddie Redmayne, Jessica Chastain version of the story of Charles Cullen. Who was convicted of killing 40, but is estimated to be the most prolific serial killer in American history, possibly having killed many, many more. He's in jail in New Jersey. But it's a very interesting film. I think both Redmayne and Chastain are very good in it. Perhaps the only thing that I would criticise about it is that it's a little bit, it backs away from the horror of it a bit. It's a slightly Dharma problem that they have, that because it was such a series of killings, he was a nurse, that was the point.
Yeah, I know all about it. It was written by one of our clients.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's very good. It's very good. I think, if anything, just perhaps a little bit sotto voce when it comes to the actual killings.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it?
It's a very, very tricky one. How you convey something as horrible as a nurse killing.
But I mean, the significant part of that story is her realization of what he was doing and her choice. Yeah, so yeah. I can see why they would focus on that rather than
on the killings.
Yeah.
Yes, it is her story.
It doesn't make sense really to do it the other way,
No,
think about it.
I mean, it's her story. She's called Amy Loughran. She's still alive. She's 58, 57, I think, and has retired as a nurse now. But it is very much her story, because in the end, she turned on a man who'd become her friend. And that was what was so poignant about it. But I do heartily recommend it. It's 2 hours and 3 minutes. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very, very, very good.
Good. I haven't watched it yet, but I will do.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Very interesting to see. So how's your week?
Fine, yeah, fine. Thanks, you?
Yeah, okay. Everything gets gets more slow. I get slower and slower and slower. And you find yourself creaking more. Yeah, each bone creaks. And
well, you're quite old now, so
I suppose I am. Yeah.
Comes with the territory, I think.
Yep.
A little bit.
I think it does a bit.
You should do less.
Do less.
Maybe you feel you're slow because you're doing as much but not as quickly.
That's why it takes longer. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. If you do less, then it won't be so bad.
Yes. Yeah. I've got to work though.
Yeah, I didn't say about work, I just meant everything
just
else.
Just in general. Well, I try. Every time I start the day, I think, oh, perhaps I can just not do anything, and then I think I've got something I've got to do. You know, I've always got something I've got to do. It's a nice thing to have, and I'm very lucky, and I mustn't complain. I'm just saying that it sometimes seems to take me longer. So, shall we?
Fair enough. Yeah, what are we doing this week?
Well, this is a lady, another suggestion from one of our listeners, whom I've used before. She's called Becky Porter. And this is about a man whom I'd forgotten about. He's called Alan Kite. Now, Alan spelled A-L-U-N, and Kite spelled K-Y-T-E. He became known as the Midlands Ripper, but most people call him the Midlands Strangler. He's a very, again, he floated under the radar for a very, very long time. So let me begin the story.
What are you going to call him?
I think we'll call him the Midlands Ripper.
Okay, so this is the Midlands Ripper.
Alan Kite was born on the 7th of July 1964, not far from Stoke-on-Trent in the Midlands, birthplace of Robbie, what's it?
Williams.
Williams, yes. He was actually convicted of a double murder, murder of two different prostitutes. But he was almost certainly killing a series of prostitutes throughout the 1980s and 90s. He's one of those figures that just floats underneath the radar. He didn't do anything that was very dramatic. And yet, if you look back at what he was responsible for, it's chilling. He was brought up in Stafford. He was a sickly child with severe asthma. But his family, and especially his mother, doted on him. He grew up to be an inconspicuous, short, balding mechanic. I mean, look at a picture of him, you wouldn't notice him. It could be anybody, literally. He did odd jobs, and then he took up lorry driving. Now, remember Robert Black?
Yeah.
He was a lorry driver who committed a series of horrible attacks throughout the country.
And got away with it for ages.
Got away with it for a very long time. He didn't have a flat or anything. He lived in hostels and bed and breakfasts. He wasn't centred anywhere. He travelled endlessly. He worked hard. He attended a lot of hospitals. His sickliness continued into adulthood. He wasn't beefy or strong particularly. And for some reason, and we'll go back to this in a moment, for some reason he developed a hatred of sex workers. And when I say hatred, I do mean hatred.
Probably because he wanted to use them.
Probably. Or was it guilt at using them?
Mm.
Or was it something to do with his mother? The doting mother that he rejected. What is abundantly clear is he never had any sensible relationships with women. He travelled relentlessly. He used to haunt motorway service stations, where, believe it or not, it's quite possible to find sex workers, particularly the ones where lorries, you know, the big lorry parks.
Mm-hmm.
It's a well-known hunting ground. But of course, we are talking about the 1980s and into the 1990s. The disappearance of sex workers, which we've talked about before, was incredibly common.
Mm.
They were always thought to have gone off to somewhere else, or there were no family particularly to look for them. They become low-slung fruit. They're easy prey. Now, it's not to say they don't deserve our compassion. They most certainly do. But it does mean that they are vulnerable.
Yeah, it's like the homeless.
Yes.
Any marginalised member of society.
Yeah. And there's no question that these women were marginalised. But they were also often people with a family. They might have a child or even two, three. And they sustained themselves by selling themselves. Anyway, the first killing that we know was committed by Alan Kite was in December 1993. He picked up a young woman called Samo Paul. Strange pronunciation. She was actually a single parent. He picked her up in Birmingham, in the red light area of Birmingham. And on the 4th of December, exceedingly rare when it comes to sex workers, she was actually reported missing. Quite unusual. But she wasn't found. Not until more than 3 weeks later, when her body was partially clothed body was spotted on the 31st of December 1993 by a horse rider. She was lying in a water-filled ditch by a lay-by about 38 miles from when she was last seen in Birmingham. It was near Junction 20 of the M1. There was, of course, because it's a remote location, there was no CCTV. All her possessions had been stolen. Inevitably, perhaps, one of the original suspects for her killing was her boyfriend, but be that as it may. But one woman, a witness, insisted she'd seen a brown Ford Sierra driven by a man who wanted to conceal his face, and including what she was absolutely certain was a dead woman on the back seat. It was near Swinford in Leicestershire, not far from where the body was actually dumped. The witness, who was, believe it or not, had worked as a pathologist, knew about dead bodies. Mm. She's like, I'm sure that's a dead woman. She was sitting bolt upright, and the car driver, as she said, was trying to conceal his face by pulling hat down. I'm sure in my heart that it was certainly not the first time Alan Kite had killed. It certainly wasn't the last. Just a few months later, Tracy Turner, another sex worker, although this time aged 30, Sammo Paul was rather younger, she was in her 20s. Tracy Turner was abducted from a service station on the M6, where she worked regularly. She was, strangely enough, virtually deaf. This was the 2nd of March 1994, 3 months since the discovery of Sammo Paul's body. She was found next day, dumped near Junction 19 of the M1. That same pattern of roadways that identifies so many. If you can do it, America, they're very famous about the I-95 killer and roads linking victims. She'd been raped, stripped and strangled. There was no connection made, however, with the Sammo Paul killing. And it was another very, very difficult case for the police. This time it's a different force. And believe it or not, not long before this second crime, Kite's second acknowledged killing, took place, there'd been a reconstruction of Sammo Paul on television. The then local television station had done reconstruction, see if they could flush out anybody who'd actually seen anything, apart from the lady who saw the brown Ford Sierra, which some people suggest encouraged Kite to kill again. I'm not sure I believe that, but there are suggestions.
I'm sure he would have done it anyway.
Oh, I'm sure he did do it anyway. But one of the eerie things about this particular killing is that a matter of days later, Kite appears at the service station where Tracy was abducted, pretending to be a reporter and wanting to write about prostitutes who work at service stations.
Classic.
Return to the scene of the crime, you might say.
Mm.
Yes. Later in March 1994, Kite abducted a sex worker, again from the Balsall Heath area of Birmingham, drove her away to a secluded area and threatened her with a Stanley knife. She begged for her life. He told her to take all her clothes off. She begged for her life and told him she was 3 months pregnant. In the end, he lost his temper and threw her naked out of the car and then threw the clothes out after her and drove off. He was never identified. The sex worker was just, I think, grateful to have survived.
Mm.
3 years pass. No more identified victims. But in December 1997, Kite attacks and rapes a woman at knife point in Weston-super-Mare. Again, believe it or not, on a motorway, or very close to one, the M5. Mm. This time she was staying in the same hostel as he was. And you can't really understand why he did it, except perhaps he'd got away with it before. He didn't think she was going to tell anybody, rather like the lady who he threw out of the car and chucked her clothes out afterwards. But to her eternal credit, she did not take this lightly. She walked round to the police station, and the police walked back with her to arrest Kite. He got 8 years for this attack. However, possibly because of Kite's actions, and this is what makes him in many ways more significant than we give him credit for, the police began to realise that there were someone or someones preying on sex workers. And they started a thing called Operation Enigma in 1997.
Was this when he was in prison?
When he was in prison. He'd by this point been arrested for the attack and charged and imprisoned for the attack on in Weston-super-Mare. In 1997, in the wake of the growing feeling among the police of the fact that sex workers were being preyed on, Operation Enigma was launched to look at the 207 unsolved murders of sex workers.
207?
207, dating back to 1986.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. It was originally, it was the first step to creating a real criminal database on violent crimes against women. We now talk about it almost as if it's obvious, but it wasn't in 1997.
No, I mean, it's not obvious enough.
No, perhaps not.
Still, I don't think.
It was run out of the National Crime Facility in Hampshire, and it concluded that there could have been as many as 4 serial killers at large, primarily targeting sex workers. Many of the Enigma killings, the so-called Enigma killings, were centred on the Midlands and Merseyside. Finally, Operation Enigma links the deaths of Sam O'Paul and Tracy to one person. And because Kite's DNA was taken when he was arrested for the attack in the hostel in Weston-super-Mare, it's finally matched. It matches semen taken from Tracy. The police approach Kite, of course, is in jail, and he denies ever having anything to do with prostitutes. It's got nothing to do with him. They then produce the lady from the who saw the brown Ford Sierra, because he admits that he actually at one point did own a brown Ford Sierra.
Mm.
So he's charged with the murders of Sam O'Paul and Tracy Turner. The DNA match is 33 million to one. You know, there's not really any doubt. And one of his former inmates, his former cellmates, gives evidence that he's been bragging about getting away with killing sex workers.
Classic.
It is, really. I mean, it's almost the sort of page one
of
the
note. A lot of tropes in this story, aren't there?
Yes. He's found guilty and given life with a minimum of 25 years. He appeals persistently, saying that it's not fair, it's too long, I didn't do anything. Well, actually, you killed 2 sex workers.
Well, minimum of 2.
Minimum of 2, well.
And assaulted several other ones.
Yes, assaulted a lady and...
Mm.
So the list of potential victims of Alan Kite includes at least five near his locus, near the Midlands area. A lady called Yvonne Coley from Birmingham, Gail Whitehouse from Wolverhampton, Jasmine Downs, Wolverhampton, Lynn Trenholm from Chester, and Barbara Finn from Coventry. And they stretch from 1986 through to 1992. Now, Kite has never been charged with any other killings, simply because I think it's difficult to find firm evidence. But according to the police, he is eligible to be considered for parole in 2025, which is not very long.
How old will he be then?
I'll just remind myself exactly. He's 58 now, so he'll be 59. Yeah. Perfectly capable of killing again.
Oof.
So, Alan Kite, he does tick a lot of boxes, doesn't he?
Yeah, big time.
You know, one of those people that you think, gosh. But nobody, no, you say Alan Kite.
I haven't heard of him before.
No one ever go, who?
Yeah.
The Midlands Ripper? Really remember him, you know. There was no dissection or dismemberment or slicing open these victims. He just killed sex workers because he didn't like sex workers. The question we have to ask, obviously, is why? What was it? What drove this man?
Well, that's a big question.
It is.
With no information.
With no answer.
Well, how could we answer? We don't have anything to base it on.
He is an absolutely fascinating case. Barely known, hardly talked about, but nevertheless clearly relentless. Who lives literally on the edge of society, living in B&Bs and hostels and driving relentlessly. He was known to drive 1,000 miles a day. You know, he was one of those people. He's this inconspicuous, bald, pasty-faced, not very tall man with a tendency to go to hospital given half a chance. He was sickly. Something was driving him. I think he's a fascinating case.
Oh, yeah, I mean, obviously something was driving him, but we don't have any idea.
We don't know what the trigger was, do we? We can't. Well, that's the Midlands Ripper.
Well, there you go. Thank you.
That's all right.
Thank you to Becky for recommending it.
Yes, thank you, Becky. That's two I've done of yours recently, so I shall give other people a chance now.
Yeah. Well, we're always grateful for the recommendations.
We are.
We're a bit slower on the responding on Instagram and email right now because I'm not doing it anymore.
No, and I'm not very good at it. So, but Molly and I will have a go at it today.
Yeah. We're just a bit. Everything's a bit slower, isn't it, Dad?
That's what I was saying earlier.
Exactly. Yeah. In all respects.
Are you doing something exciting this week? This week, you're doing something new and exciting.
This week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to the Design Museum tomorrow.
Oh.
To see an exhibition on surrealist objects.
Oh, good.
Where's
that? Is that in Islington?
No, it's Kensington now.
Oh, right, okay.
I went to Sadler's Wells last night to watch some dance, interpretive dance version of Alice in Wonderland.
Crikey. Wow.
I love a bit of culture, me.
Yeah, say that again. Crikey. All I can do is watch the Good Nurse.
I love a bit of culture.
Yes. Well, you're an example to us all, darling.
Well, you know, I live in London, so a bit of a shame not to go and do something, isn't it?
I should also add that Molly has arrived this morning wearing the most enormous pair of boots with a great zippers up the front. They're huge.
They're cool.
They're just large.
Well.
They're great fun, though.
Thanks.
They're great fun.
I don't think they're as big as the other ridiculous ones that I was wearing before last year.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure.
Well, there you go.
They're Ganni.
What?
They're by a designer called Ganni.
Oh, okay. I wouldn't have known that if you...
A very on-trend dad.
Oh, well, I'm not. Well, I'm glad you are.
Everybody loves your outfits. That's not true at all.
Well, sweetheart, could you just remind us all how the listeners can contact us?
Well, when Jeffrey answers the messages on Instagram.
Yes, all right. Okay, no, I've got the hint.
Instagram is bloodties_pod, and as is Twitter, and you can email us at bloodties.podcast@gmail.com. But you might be best going to Jeffrey's website, jeffreywantzel.com.
That's right.
And you'll find his email on there, and then you'll get straight to the source.
Yes.
And if you do that, you're most likely to get the response.
Yes. More likely, anyway.
Yeah.
More likely. Well, thanks, darling. Thank you.
And thank you to all the people that help us, our producer, Sam Brain, my brother Dan that did the music, my friend George who drew our caricature, to Jeffrey for all the hard work, and to you, the listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you, too, to Molly, who first thought up this wild scheme 5 years ago, and here we are, still podding away, or casting away, or podcasting away.
I like podding.
Podding, well, it's podding. Keep podding. But most of all, as I say many times, please do be careful out there.